Welcome to the Bitcoin Infinity Academy, brought to you by the Plan B Network and Bitbox. This is the second course on my second book, Independence Reimagined, from 2020. I'm Knut Swanholm, and I'm here, as always, with Luke DeWolf. How are you today, Luke?
Doing great, Knut. Happy to be here. Today's chapter is called Slowly, Then All at Once. I'm looking forward to this one.
Yes, this is about the catch-up effect. I mean, what Parker Lewis called in a beautiful article, gradually then suddenly, back in the day. It's like 5 years old, that article at this point, I think. But it's about how Bitcoin is more likely to have an explosive adoption curve, an exponential one, than a linear one. So let's dive in.
Let's dive in. And before we get started, just a quick reminder that the best way to get involved is to go to our Geyser page at geyser.fund/project/infinity. There you can get all the details about what we're doing in the academy, and you can get involved and join the course there. So check that out. Okay, this is Slowly, Then All at Once. In 1869, Henry Heinz founded the Heinz Company. And a couple of years later, their now iconic, albeit slightly moronic, ketchup bottle was first introduced to the world. The bottle provides a perfect metaphor for how disruptive technologies spread over the globe. In the past, technologies were mainly mechanical and made up of physical stuff. This meant that producing them took time, and, more importantly, that it took time for people to realize how their fellow man could improve his life by adopting the technology and thereby developing a personal demand for it. In other words, the process implied by Metcalfe's law took a lot longer than it does now, in an era where technological progress is mostly computerized and made up of bits and bytes rather than physical building blocks. Metcalfe's law states that the value of a communications network is proportional to its number of users squared. For example, it took the automobile 62 years to reach 50 million users, while the same process took Facebook only 4 years. The credit card has been around since 1958, and it took 28 years for it to hit 50 million users. Improvements to the monetary system usually take longer for people to adopt than other technologies, because they change societies at their very foundation, especially if the technology alters existing power structures and hierarchies, since those at the top of the food chain will always try to delay any development that threatens their advantageous positions. All right, so the gradually then suddenly effect.
Yeah, Metcalfe's law is interesting. So it's important to remember that this is true for communications networks. And it's kind of easy to visualize if you just draw lines between the users. So if you have two users, there's just one line between the two nodes, right? And if you have three, then there are three lines. And if you have four, there are not four, but six lines, because you can draw diagonals as well. And five, then you get a star-shaped thing. So it grows exponentially with each added user. Since a telephone, for instance, if two people have a telephone, then there's one person to call. And if there's four people in the telephone network, then each and every user has three people to call. So it's not only you that has three people to call, but everyone has three people to call, and so on and so forth. And money is a communications network. Like, Bitcoin is a communications network more than anything. It's the language of value that we express to one another. Language of appreciation, if you will.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point here, that it might get lost why this type of thing would apply to Bitcoin. And I think this also hits on some of the other points about how basically Bitcoin is the merging of money and communications. Like, it's Lynn Alden had the point that for a while their communications was going faster than money. But with Bitcoin, it allowed money to fully catch up to the speed of the communication networks, basically. Now, it's not like we don't have Visa and all those other things like credit cards and stuff basically run at internet speed also, but they don't do final settlement at the same rate. So it's, yeah, just a few interesting points there. So I think everything we're going to talk about, that's why it all applies to Bitcoin, basically.
Yeah, and if you compare it to like gold or cash, if now cash was connected to gold still, which it isn't, but then you can still only trade with the people you physically interact with. So that would limit the effect of the Metcalfe's law thing, because your communications network doesn't grow, since you're limited by space. when it's on the internet, you're not. You're like connected to everyone.
Exactly. Yeah. I think let's continue and get into this a little bit more deeper.
Yeah.
When all the underlying technology needed for a new innovation to take flight is already in place, things can go very fast. The mobile game Pokemon Go, for instance, had been downloaded by 50 million users only 19 days after its release. All the infrastructure needed for the word to spread about the game was already there, in everyone's pocket. Bitcoin was first introduced to the world on January 3, 2009. It is impossible to know exactly how many Bitcoin users there are in the world because of Bitcoin's pseudonymous nature. But it's estimated that around 30 million people around the globe have at least some Satoshis at the time of writing. Keep in mind that there's no limit to how many wallets a single person can have, and one single wallet could act as a custodial service to multiple different users. It is also impossible to know whether old, seemingly inactive wallets are just made up of lost coins, or if their owners are simply hodling and not spending their funds. 11 years may seem like a long time for an internet-based technology to spread, but remember that Bitcoin had no marketing behind it whatsoever. It took the mobile phone 12 years to reach 50 million users, and this technology had a multitude of multinational corporations behind it, all pouring vast amounts of resources into marketing their own product more aggressively than their competitors. Bitcoin grows organically, which means that it relies solely on its users to educate their peers and spread the word about it. Some of the infrastructure needed for Bitcoin to flourish, like the internet, was in place at its conception. But all of the yet-to-be-invented products, like hardware wallets, exchanges, steel tubes for private key protection, and Lightning ATMs, had to be invented by enthusiasts along the way. All of this while being constantly thwarted and opposed by those who stand to lose something from Bitcoin's existence, namely banks and governments. All right, so that's the explanation why this applies to Bitcoin and actually some of the reasons why it's taking shorter and longer than other things at the same time.
Yeah, so it follows the same path, but there are so many hurdles in the way. And also there is no marketing except us Bitcoiners ourselves. Like the marketing being done around Bitcoin is usually for shitcoin exchanges or paper Bitcoins like ETFs and stuff like other Bitcoin derivatives and companies trying to piggyback off of the success of Bitcoin. But Bitcoin itself is not a corporation. It's not a commercial entity. It's just a language. So it'll take its time. I have a pet theory that it will develop in the same way that English became spoken by every single European. Like I remember back in the 90s, I was sailing around and visited like Poland and East Germany, and no one spoke English. Like it was completely, you know, their own separate languages. And Europe used to be like that a lot. But this generation that's growing up with internet, they speak English to each other all the time. Like even if they don't speak their original languages anymore, like the language of the internet is English. And therefore, my daughter is Swedish. But she speaks English to her Swedish friends. And I think that's inevitable when a language becomes dominant that way. And I think it's inevitable for Bitcoin too. Like a generation from now, every single kid will have grown up with this thing existing. So there's no reason why they wouldn't use it.
Yes, exactly. And I think that the key points here that I really enjoyed are that first of all, the Bitcoin's growth is organic and it's competing against marketing teams. It's why other cryptos have had a chance to exist, basically. They're only marketing, and Bitcoin is competing entirely against that. And it's competing against the marketing of every other investment, every other company, whatever. So Bitcoin's growth being fully organic and still being at these levels is quite something just with that. But then that there's even opposition to Bitcoin, active FUD against Bitcoin. I don't think there's any specific technology or something or investment type or whatever that gets so much FUD or so much opposition to it, recommendations against using it. So it's quite something that Bitcoin has managed to get this far. But it is also a good point to mention that it was pretty much the rails were in place for Bitcoin to exist. There's these charts that show all the technologies that needed to be in place for Bitcoin to work, all the communication stuff. Really, it's a chart of what it needed to make the internet, because the internet is really what fuels Bitcoin. But there are other things were needed too, other developments such as hashing algorithms and various other things. So there's just so many things that came together to make Bitcoin work. And now there's Bitcoin, boom. And then on top of that, Bitcoin has to be iterated on in order for it to turn into not just a layer one blockchain, but that we have the Lightning Network and all of these other things. So it's really quite something how these early days of Bitcoin, so-called, and yes, we are still early, have evolved, and that Bitcoin has grown so much as it has, even with the headwinds and the competition against everything else.
Yeah, and to add to that, I mean, a lot of the FUD around it and a lot of the bad-mouthing is because of these crypto scams and these alternative coins and all the people who tried to piggyback off of Bitcoin's success. They sort of drawn Bitcoin down in the mud with them. People who are yet to make the distinction between Bitcoin and crypto confuse the two, and they don't see the difference, and therefore they don't understand it. So it gets the same crap thrown at it as all the other cryptos. And I think this is a large part of it. The other thing is like how it began, Silk Road, where you could buy drugs online. That's like the first big thing for Bitcoin. So in its history, in its past, there is something that most people don't really like. Yeah, it is anarchist money. I mean, and it needs to be permissionless to work, and you need to be able to run your own node and not give a fuck about what your government tells you. So like inherently all governments would be against it. So it certainly has its enemies, but yeah, it's only a matter of time before they have to play ball and give in. You know, those faces, first they laugh at you, then they fight you, then what? I don't remember what the faces are, but we're certainly in one of the latter faces there, where they sort of have to give in.
Yeah, because it ends with, then you win. So I think that's the important one. yeah, that is the important one.
Yeah,
let's continue exploring this concept. The very meta, indeed intersubjective, world of the in-game virtual goods market has an estimated value of around $50 billion at the time of writing. Compare this to the total market cap of Bitcoin at the time of writing, $130 billion. None of these items have any so-called intrinsic value or use case outside the virtual worlds they exist in. This market shows no sign of slowing down either. Just this very niche economy alone is a huge potential use case for Bitcoin in general, and the Lightning Network specifically. Imagine a world in which gamers could stake and earn real Bitcoin for their in-game efforts. The gaming industry moves quickly, and once they realize what this means, those $50 billion will be added to the Bitcoin economy in the blink of an eye. Who in their right mind would prefer lousy Warcraft gold or Linden dollars to real, absolutely scarce Satoshis? Okay, this is a quite funny aside, and I believe you have entirely flipped on this particular point, and I take a slightly different position to it, right?
No, I don't think I flipped on it. Yeah, first of all, there's no such thing as intrinsic value. And then there's other stuff here, like Linden dollars. Who remembers those? That was in a game called Second Life, I believe, which was just the real world, but online, which made it very stupid. It didn't live for very long. There's also, like, I giggle at these long, complicated sentences I tried to shit out when, like, this is early in my writing career, and I don't think I would have written that first sentence the same way today. Yeah, but yeah, this in-game market is still there, and it still blows my mind that they haven't figured out the Lightning Network. I think it has something to do with what you're allowed to do in certain jurisdictions, and if you want your game to be global, then you sort of need to play ball with the fiat overlords. What do you think?
Yeah, well, we've had some discussions on this, and I think one of the points here is that this is the only, controversially, this is the only use case that I actually acknowledge is a pretty decent one for a token, so to say, because these virtual currencies and virtual worlds, so to say, I think the reason that they don't go to Bitcoin in a native way is because they see some benefit in still having control of those in-game economies. So they want to be the fiat money printer of their own in-game world and have some control over so-called issuance rate and whatever. So this is the place where I say, okay, you can still tie that to some kind of blockchain. Don't worry, I'm getting out of the bad buzzwords here shortly. Because I definitely see the point, and the crypto gaming world is a real thing. I think it probably was one of those parts that died in the 2019-2020 thing, but I do understand that they still exist somewhat. The whole idea is that you can trade these virtual goods or whatever amongst each other and not have to go back to the server of the person. The value can be set by the community and all this. And then the tokens themselves have their own issuance rates and all this. And so the game itself can be somewhat controlled and all this. This is something that people find interesting and there is demand for. And the reason why I don't have a real objection to this is that it's not trying to be money. It's not trying to be the future of digital finance. They're just trying to be video games and entertain people. And so I agree with you on the point specifically that if they were to link this to Bitcoin, then all is good. Ignore your crappy blockchain X that is just meant for this garbage. Get it onto Bitcoin. And I'm also caveating that I don't mean get it onto the Bitcoin base chain. Use something like Liquid. Use the Lightning Network. But don't put it on the Bitcoin blockchain itself, because that's silly. You don't need to do that. It's much more expensive than you would need to do if you were to just use Liquid, for example.
Arc seems like the correct protocol to use for stuff like this. Like,
right.
Or correct layer. Maybe that's the correct word. I mean, the thing I agree that, you know, it's a free market, cryptos need to exist. The thing I have trouble with understanding is why you would need a blockchain at all if it's not, like, the whole point of it is that it's super duper secure for forever. And if it isn't, then you might as well use a spreadsheet and be the central bank that you want to be without the charade of adding it to a blockchain. I mean, that can still be done. They're not really trading it peer-to-peer if it needs to appear in a block that was mined by, you know, this same entity that issued the coin. So, like, why go through all these hoops? And I think that's sort of for the most part, all of that was just like riding on the wakes of the buzzword salads that were popular a couple of years back, saying that you had a blockchain and saying that you had your own quote unquote token. Yeah. But yeah, I agree with the live and let live part. I mean, if people want to fall for that, then good for them, I guess.
Well, I don't think there's falling for it at all, exactly, except for the part that as soon as you bring in something that can be traded for eventually real currency, it turns into some kind of money-making venture, and people operate differently when that's the case, as opposed to if this were something that's entirely contained in their own little space. That's the caveat that I would put in here, is that these virtual games stop really being games once you inject money into the process. But again, and so I think the point of actually having the blockchain is so you don't have to go back to the server every time you want to do stuff. People can just trade stuff around between each other. And then when you want to go interact with the game, then you go talk to the game, the people. So I think that's the reasoning, and you might not get it, but you don't get a lot of things.
No. Yeah. But I wonder why, I mean, the block would still have to be mined by someone, right?
Well, if we're talking about Liquid or Lightning or whatever it is, or Arc, not really.
We're not talking about that. We're talking about the crypto tokens attached to the games.
No, I'm talking about yes. But I am talking about that if we were to actually put this stuff onto Bitcoin and you were just using Liquid, like, yes, technically the Federation has to produce a block for the transaction to occur. But like, yeah, it's not a Bitcoin mined block in that case. And I think Arc operates differently and all this. But even on the old crypto blockchains, and I know about this because I played around with it, right? And yeah, and it's these total crap things. Like, they're not being mined. It's just they're producing blocks and validating that valid transactions. It's just a communications network.
But
it's not a blockchain in the real sense.
So did World of Warcraft with their gold, and that was just a server, a spreadsheet on a server, right? And
no, sure, I get it. When it's these crypto things, I mean, I think the point is they think they're more decentralized than that. And you can, they do all hook into these ecosystems, right? They hook into that you can go onto some exchange or whatever and trade it for USDT and then change it into something else.
Yeah.
That's part of the point, is that you can have blockchain X. Like, I'm not going to call anything out because they're not worth it, but like, you can have blockchain X and you can go onto all of these crypto exchanges or DeFi platforms or whatever and trade them for whatever you want.
Yeah.
Right. That's the fun of it. That's the thing that hooks people in and gets them to become degens. And I think a lot of the fun would actually disappear if you moved on to something like Liquid. But there are games that are operating on Liquid, like Samson's got one, right?
Yeah. The space game there.
It's
a sci-fi
that's
game.
Good enough.
Yeah.
Infinite Fleet, I think.
Infinite Fleet, yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
we should be characters in that game.
We should do a tie-in with Infinite Fleet, the Bitcoin Infinity, everything.
Never mind, play a concert within Infinite Fleet. Hey,
oh,
Samson.
Anyway, to tie this off, because this is a massive, massive, massive tangent, like, I 100% see that this is a thing that people like to do. People like to do gambling. People like to play with stuff. People like interesting things to do. And right now, that's mostly on the crypto side of it all. And hooking it into Bitcoin one day is, I think, a no-brainer.
Yeah, and so, as long as it's not inscriptions and stamps and shit that clogs the blockchain. Like, yeah. So,
but again, we come back to that the current state of things make it capable to do that. And I hate to take a position that the realist position that I don't agree with ideologically is that the only thing that is actually going to price these things out is fees. But my node doesn't allow transactions with tons of arbitrary data. So perhaps your node could not allow those transactions also if you run knots and don't upgrade to Core V30.
Yes. Now the tangent is tangenting a lot. Here.
So maybe we should just continue.
We should just go on. I was going to say something about Warcraft Gold and those floors in office buildings in China that made money off of that and sold it for dollars and people got hacked and blah, blah, blah. But fuck that. This is not a show about Warcraft. So let's go on.
You did write about it in your book, though, and that's the point of this show. So
yeah.
Tangent
maybe
complete.
It's in here. Yeah.
Yep. Moving on. Hyperbitcoinization is a concept that is highly theoretical at this point in time. But as the Bitcoin economy continues to grow, the likelihood that hyperbitcoinization will happen sooner or later increases exponentially. The exponentiality stems from Metcalfe's law primarily, and there are a bunch of domino effects that could trigger such an event. As the domino effects will fuel each other, hyperbitcoinization will probably play out a lot faster than its opposite, hyperinflation, normally does. The first of the domino effects is the fear of missing out, or FOMO, from both people and financial institutions. When prices rise, people think they'll miss the opportunity if they don't hop onto the train fast enough, and a bull run ensues. This has happened in Bitcoin many times before, and each time it happens again, attentive market participants notice that this might be a trend rather than a bubble. Sooner or later, some central banker and maybe a finance minister here and there will notice this too, despite their incompetence in these matters. In a very short period of time, it will be obvious that nation-states which embrace this technology will get richer at a much higher pace than those who try to fight it. This will, in turn, trigger a much bigger FOMO cycle, a cycle in which nation-states try to out-Bitcoin each other whilst at the same time trying to fight for their own survival. As the by then astronomical Bitcoin price has effectively turned every individual that was ahead of the game and got in early into a sovereign entity of the same financial magnitude as some of the nation states. Well, fear of missing out.
Yeah, I get goosebumps from the surrealness of this whole thing because this paragraph is written 5 years ago and next month I'm going to El Salvador to speak in the presidential palace about Bitcoin. And like, if anyone would have told me that back here, that a nation would actually adopt Bitcoin as their national currency And I mean, it's just completely mind blowing to me that all of these things are playing out. Same with the, I remember, I don't want to pound my chest too much here, but I wrote something about, I was not the only one, of course, but this idea that you could attach mining rigs to the renewable energy sources, that is totally playing out right now. And it's so beautiful to see. And there's these mining facilities in Africa and stuff, like things that we imagined collectively on Bitcoin Twitter back in the day. It's all like playing out now. And it's just so, so wild to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And even if El Salvador specifically no longer has Bitcoin as legal tender, I don't think any of these countries actually need to make Bitcoin legal tender. It's just about adopting. Adopting Bitcoin doesn't mean mandating its use. It means using it, acquiring it and hodling it and et cetera. And they appear to be doing quite well with that particular regard. So it doesn't matter that the people of El Salvador aren't mandated to accept Bitcoin and use it. The treasury, the Bitcoin treasury in El Salvador continues to grow, and theoretically Bhutan and maybe a few other places are starting to accumulate themselves. So yeah, the cool thing here is that there's 21 million Bitcoins, but there are way more than 21 million entities that want Bitcoin. In fact, every human, every group of people, every company, every nation state is going to want Bitcoin eventually. And so the math on that is pretty fun. Yeah. If you're in Bitcoin now, if you're listening to this show, possibly ever, you're probably ahead of many nation states.
Yeah, someone made an equation about that, the mathing behind that, which is the next book we'll go through here on the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. So yeah, everything divided by 21 million playing out in real time, slowly but surely, slowly, but then all at once, hopefully.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, I think the FOMO has actually started to die down with so-called retail investors. I think because of unit bias, mostly, that Bitcoin is above $100,000, therefore that's inaccessible to people and many don't even attempt it. I think that's another thing that's keeping the cryptos going, is that the unit bias is better. So they think it's easier to buy one ETH instead of one Bitcoin, and so they buy that instead. But regardless of whatever is happening in the world, and there's some wars going on and people are a little bit skittish and the money printer isn't printing as quickly and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, we've still doubled in the last year, right? And as long as we double every 4 years, we basically outpace the halving, right? So at least we're beating that. And I see no end to that particular trend.
No, and that's amazing. I mean, crypto is dying, make no mistake about it. I mean, if you compare it to 2017, when these things were actually Ether was worth like a third of, Ether had a market cap that was like up to a third of what Bitcoin was, I think, or something like that. And it never topped that. Even when it had its second hype in 2021, it was never half than the value in Bitcoin back in 2017. So, and now, nowadays, Bitcoin moves more in a day than the entire, more dollars is in that than in the entire rest of the crypto space. So it's a lot smaller than it used to be. And that's, of course, great. This big market crash, I think it was after Trump threatened some tariffs to China or whatever it was, everything crashed. Most cryptos crashed by like 90%. So many salad hands just kicked out of the market, and while Bitcoin dropped like 10%. And yeah, that's going to keep on happening. It's a purging of, you know, stupid money from the clever money.
Yeah, so I think the point is, even since writing this, I don't think anyone has seen the kind of blow off top that maybe we've been asking for, but it moves. And when it moves, slowly, and it adds up over time is maybe currently what the Bitcoin cycles are doing. And if the predictions of this particular chapter and the Gradually But Suddenly book are correct, the suddenly will be very sudden and very surprising, because we're at a different magnitude here. For anyone to be impressed at a Bitcoin move now, we're getting our Omega candle.
Yeah. historically, most days of the year, Bitcoin will go down. But if you hodl during that week where it goes up, then, I mean, that's why traders lose, because they miss that week when it just skyrockets and 10x's. And, I mean, that's still a scenario that is very likely in this cycle. I wouldn't count it out at all that we see $1 million Bitcoin. Like, I mean, it's still October, isn't it? Fingers crossed.
Any day now. I think we'll release this after October, but we'll see. Anyway, let's continue here. Another domino effect that could trigger hyper-Bitcoinization is the currency wars currently being fought by the superpowers of the world: the United States, China, and the EU. Their virtual printing presses conjure up more and more dollars, yuan, and euros out of thin air, causing extreme short-term instability and eventually significant inflation. This has happened to every other fiat currency that ever existed, and it's just a matter of time before it will happen to the ones in current use as well. Other central bank-issued currencies might replace them, of course. The euro is only 20 years old, after all. But every time this happens, the public will be a little more aware of the deceptive nature of fiat monies. There's only one alternative to inflationary currencies in the digital realm, and as long as it continues to do what it does, people will consider reallocating their wealth to it. Yeah, so the currencies and the money printing as the other effect.
Yeah, I had a conversation with Professor Peter Saint-Onge about this yesterday, and how fiat currencies die in a great big crash, and then countries go back to a gold standard. That's usually what happens. It happens with all the great civilizations like Rome and whatnot. And I think the question is now, when it inevitably happens to the dollar and all the other fiat currencies, will we skip the gold step and go straight to Bitcoin or not? And yeah, that's what a lot of our conversation yesterday was about. And I think it's a very interesting question.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, gold is still on a bit of a tear. It's doubled in a year, if I'm remembering correctly from the latest meme I saw on the topic.
In Bitcoin terms?
Well, that's not what I was talking about. In US dollar terms, but I'm making a separate point here, Knut. Considering that it's doubled in US dollar terms, the gold bugs have some wind in their sails. They think they're getting some momentum here, and maybe that's true. Maybe there is going to be a wave of influx into gold as the store of value market. It does move the goalpost, right? That Bitcoin has a little bit further to go before it catches gold in market cap terms, in US dollars, but also in general, because the valuation of Bitcoin in US dollars has to be higher in order to catch gold. That's the point.
Yeah, I think Bitcoin is still around 5% of the entire gold market in terms of value. So we still have a long way to go before we eat just gold and then eat everything else too. But just that is super bullish, I think.
Yeah, again, indicating how much runway we have and how early we actually are. Being only 5% of the gold cap is pretty amazing.
It is.
All right, let's continue the discussion. It's hard to imagine what a Bitcoin-denominated world would look like. But a natural effect of a more well-oiled free market and a more precise division of labor is that more and more people will be able to work less and earn more. It's easy to underestimate how powerful these mechanisms are, because we've never truly seen them in action on a global scale before. All we have are historical examples of different eras and places where an almost free market has been available and the enormous riches that this has brought to the people living there. Hong Kong is one such example. An inflation-free global economy would make every good extremely cheap, but would, at the same time, remove the need for merchants to store a surplus of everything as they do now, as everyone would be less prone to buy frivolous things they don't need because of the ever-increasing value of saving rather than spending. The velocity of money, which the currently dominant Keynesian economic theory holds as the most important metric in an economy, is only important if the market participants buy goods and services that make them more productive. In other words, it only works if people invest their money instead of wasting it on consumable goods. In a Bitcoin-denominated world economy, the total number of transactions per time unit would go down, while the number of unnecessary goods and services sold per time unit would go down drastically. In other words, the world would be a better, more effective, less stressful, and more environmentally friendly place. Yes, looking at some of the effects of hyperbitcoinization.
Yeah, some things. I would write this slightly differently nowadays. I would probably throw in something about Jevons' paradox in here, and that deflation does not necessarily mean less consumption. If you look at computers, that's the most obvious example. You have Moore's Law, so computers get cheaper every like 2.5 years. They have in cost in terms of computing power per dollar. So that has been deflationary for 50 years, and people buy more and more computers every year, and computer parts, and, you know, ASICs, hangars full of ASICs. So I think that deflation does not necessarily lead to lower consumption. It just shifts the focus from quantity to quality, and that's a very good thing. The opposite of equality is quality, and we want more quality in society. This overconsumption of bullshit, misallocating resources, is what we want to get away from. And I view this, just to visualize it to myself, is that if you have a 2% inflation rate, then those 2% inevitably go to frivolous shit that people don't need. At least those 2% do, because of people getting 2% more reckless with their economic decisions. This is an oversimplification, I know, but it's kind of I like building up these mental tools for visualizing things like that to explain them to myself. And I think the quality over quantity point is the overarching point of this paragraph.
Yeah, I like that a lot. The Bitcoin will shift the economy to quality instead of quantity. It's great. And that only things of quality will be produced and they will have demand for it. And that's great. The environmentalists should love it. I also really, I forget when the last time we covered this, that the opposite of quality is quality. Equality is quality. Yeah, that's quite a good one. I think I remember we talked about that a few times some months ago.
It's in Clown World a lot, I think.
Yeah, that's probably why.
And
that's
it ties into politics more there. But yeah, this is already playing out. You and I are more careful spending our sats than spending our euros. And so is every other Bitcoiner out there. So it's already playing out right in front of our eyes.
Love it. I think let's finish off the chapter. Keep in mind that while it is true that Bitcoin is an experiment, the ever-increasingly inflating, soon-to-be cashless, digital fiat monetary system is an even bigger experiment. Never before have the banks had such surveillance capabilities as they do now. All of your debit cards, all of your credit cards, and all of your banking apps are being monitored on a scale never seen before in history. Physical cash is being abolished around the globe at an ever-increasing rate. It's becoming easier and easier for everyone to spend more and more every day. Merchants are increasingly required to implement KYC and AML policies everywhere. Savings accounts have negative interest rates, even if you don't take inflation into account. Some banks require their customers to spend a certain amount every month in order to keep their checking accounts. The list goes on and on. What this does, apart from building a nightmarish dystopian surveillance machine, is putting up immense barriers for everyone outside the system trying to get in. Good luck getting a decent loan if you're an ex-con, an undocumented refugee, a political activist, or even if you're just unemployed at the moment. Even if you believe that your soul belongs to some deity's supposed offspring, your ass belongs to the system as long as you stay dependent on it for your survival. So, how do we break the spell? How do we make our leaders change their minds and rethink the whole thing? It's simple. We don't. Because there is no we. It's not them versus us. It's you versus everyone trying to control you. It has always been. Are you in the driver's seat or not? That's the question. Red pill or blue pill? Your choice. Yep.
Yep. Or orange pill. No, but I think this paragraph speaks for itself very much. It's the which way Western man meme puts into words. We can either go to Orwellian dystopian future, or we can go to individualist heaven. That's the choice we have. But we have to take matters into our own hands. And that's the important point. Find your own path, find your own way, and use whatever freedom tools are available, because the freer you are, the better everyone else on Earth is off. Like the better off everyone else on Earth is. So because the free market is such a beautiful thing. So yeah, promoting freedom. Excelsior.
Yeah, you know, the whole thing with it is that the system is so robust. Like if you try to put money into your bank account, they'll ask you where it came from, you know, cash. And it all has to flow through the gates that they put up for you, right? Like you have to get money into your bank account by a means that is approved. You have to pay the taxes on that, whether that's income tax or capital gains tax or an invoice that has VAT on it or whatever it is. And that's the only way to get money into your bank account that won't eventually get picked up by the government. And they say, hey, you've got to pay some kind of fine or even go to jail because you did things wrong or whatever. So it's just impossible to not live inside of this system, except the opt-out, right? And that's Bitcoin. And then everything you do with Bitcoin is untraceable. And I shouldn't say that too hard. Like you make on-chain transactions and the on-chain transactions are visible. But, you know, if you know what you're doing, a UTXO, a one Bitcoin address sending some Bitcoin to another Bitcoin address doesn't tell anyone very much. And if you use Lightning and if you use all these other things, there are ways around it. So yeah, Bitcoin is the opt-out and it's the way out of the system, like we've been talking about so often lately and Jeff Booth talks about and all this. So yep, yeah. And covered more in future books, obviously.
Absolutely. I mean, the banks, that not only do they ask you where the money came from, if you try to withdraw money, they ask you what you're going to do with it. So it's all gatekeeping all the way. The bank is, as I say a lot, like it's a 2 out of 3 multisig between you, the state, and the bank. And you have the only key that requires both the other keys. They have a master key. So it's not yours, and it's not even money in the first place. It's fiat, which is fiduciary media, made up of thin air and created out of debt. So every single monetary bill in your wallet is owed by someone to someone else. There's just no getting around that. 99.999% of it is debt that is owed by someone to someone else. And that's the tragic comedy we're living in, and that's what we're opting out of.
Absolutely. Well, this has been a great chapter, again, discussing the topic of essentially this gradually but suddenly, how do you say it?
Gradually, then suddenly.
Right. The catch-up effect. So hopefully we're in store for a gigantic burst of ketchup coming out of this particular bottle.
Yeah, we need to catch up or something. And anyway, you should go and check out the Plan B Network and their educational efforts other than the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. They have a lot of great educational resources. So do go to planb.network and figure out more. And if there's a course for you there, and come to Lugano here late October. I mean, this won't be out until after Lugano, I guess, but come to Lugano next year then. And also get a Bitbox, our favorite hardware wallet. Looks like this. Here's one. And these have the latest security chips installed, and they're super secure, super convenient, easy to use interface. Use the Bitcoin only firmware. That's the only one we recommend. We don't recommend the fucking shitcoins because we hate them. But the new Nova edition also has a plug it directly into your iPhone kind of thing. So go to bitbox.swiss to figure out more and use code Infinity. Everywhere on the internet, I guess. I think we have code Infinity for, oh, what was that? Yeah, the Glock course now. We have an Infinity code there. So if you want to keep yourself safe from kidnapping, you can use code Infinity. I mean, code Infinity everywhere. Why not? Try it out.
All right. This has been the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.